Right. Today I'll be talking about our research at Quantum Valley Ideas Lab, where we've been looking predominantly at RF electric field sensing using Rydberg atom electrometry in room temperature vapor cells, so not quite cold atoms, but here's my obligatory picture of the Rydberg atom. And in this talk, I'll mostly be focusing on the fact that Rydberg atoms have very strong dipole moments. So if you look at a typical Rydberg transition that we're using in cesium, you have something that's on the order of several thousand EA naught or atomic units. And that's massive compared to dipole moments of, say, even other transitions in that atom. And what that gives you is extremely high sensitivity to the presence of external radio frequency RF electric fields. And now you can use this to manipulate atoms, but you can also use it to sense what the amplitude of the RF electric field is. And we do this at room temperature in usually cesium or sometimes rubidium vapor cells that are all dielectric. So these sensors function by using, here, this is a typical setup where you have two lasers that are spatially overlapped and counterpropagating. Could be more lasers, which I'll talk about later. But some lasers to excite from the ground state of the cesium up to the Rydberg state. And then once it's in the Rydberg state, it becomes sensitive to RF electric fields. And that can be something in the megahertz range all the way up to hundreds of gigahertz or more. We're mostly focused right now on something that's on the order of a gigahertz to over 100 gigahertz range. So if we start with a single laser, so we start with a probe laser, and this is usually the one that we're going to be looking at the transmission of. So the way we sense the RF electric field is we're looking at changes in the absorption and transmission of our vapor cell on that probe laser. So if you start with a probe laser, here I've shown it as a function of the detuning of it, you get a broad absorption curve. Now if you add the coupling laser, you get instead this dark state, which is known as the electromagnetically induced transparency, where you get increased transmission when you're on the resonance of these atomic transitions. And now if I add an external RF electric field, which is something, again, like tens or hundreds of gigahertz, then this peak at high-ish, high fields, which I'll talk about in a moment, this peak splits into two. And so you see a change in the transmission of the probe laser most dramatically when all the transitions are on resonance. And that allows us to sense electric fields, the RF electric fields. In particular, there's two regimes that are of interest. One is at larger RF electric fields, in which case these peaks, these EIT features split, and that splitting is directly, if you can measure the splitting of the two peaks, then it directly translates to an amplitude of the RF electric field that you've experienced. And this is a very nice, simple formula. Notice there's 2 pi, which is known exactly, h bar, constant that's extremely well known, and the dipole moment of your atom, which is also a very well-known number. And so you don't need to really know anything. You don't have to calibrate this. It doesn't matter how you fabricated the cell. It doesn't matter what your laser conditions are. You have this nice simple formula. And in principle, if you measure the splitting, you know what your electric field amplitude is. And this is very nice as from a practical standpoint. On the other hand, if we go to lower, weaker RF electric fields, then these peaks start to get closer and closer together. So they go from the green peak to the red peak to this grayish peak. And eventually they start to overlap. You can no longer distinguish them. At that point, you're in what's known as the amplitude regime, where you can still sense an RF electric field based solely on a small change in amplitude of that peak. Now, this allows you to measure very weak amplitude RF electric fields, but it doesn't give you the benefits of the calibration that you saw in the Ohler-Towns regime. So you can measure this, and if you know a bunch of properties, approximately, if you're in certain conditions, and you know what your laser Rabi frequency is, so you know its power, its beam size, you know some of the decay rates of the states you're using, then you can get an approximate expression where you can extract what that electric field amplitude was if you measure that change in amplitude. Or otherwise, you have to calibrate it against some known electric field. Now, this is doable, but it's not quite as convenient. And we'll talk about ways. One of the main themes of my presentation is going to be, how do we extend this regime, the Euler-Townes regime, to as low of a RF electric field amplitude as we can? Now, I'm going to briefly mention some of the advantages of these sensors compared to what's a traditional way of measuring a gigahertz field is some metallic antenna, where you're looking at electron motion that's induced in some sort of metal, and then you're reading out electrically. That's been the industry standard for forever. But one of the nice things about this sort of vapor cell technique is, one, as you saw, that self-calibration. So if you're in that Euler-Townes regime where you measure the peak splitting, you know what the electric field is. Very simply, you don't care. Yeah, there's no sensitivity to exactly your calibration or your fabrication or anything like that. Another benefit of these cells is they're not made of metal. So you can make these entirely of dielectrics, and that means your field is far less perturbed. So you're not actually perturbing very much the field that you're trying to measure. And that's very advantageous when you're measuring very weak fields. It's also very stable. Atoms are the same wherever you are. And you can make these vapor cells extremely small, something like a millimeter depth to several centimeters. You can nanofabricate these things, make them really tiny. And then that opens up all sorts of possibilities of sub-wavelength imaging or near-field measurements. Now, we have all these possible advantages of using these sensors. What can we do? What is still unknown, or what can we improve about them? In the first part of my talk, I'm going to ask the question of what limits the temporal resolution of these RF electric field sensors. If I have a very rapid pulse modulated RF electric field, and that's extremely important, for example, in radar, where you're looking at timing a pulse that's kind of echoed off something and coming back, if you can time that well, then you know how far away your target was. And that's also applicable in a lot of communications where you're looking at things like amplitude modulation or pulse modulation. And so we're going to ask, what are the things that contribute from an atomic perspective on the temporal resolution that we can get to detecting pulses? And what are the actual practical limits as well? In the second part of my talk, I'm going to ask the question of, how do we improve sensitivity, which is really the key metric of these kinds of sensors? What is the weakest field that I can detect in the shortest amount of time? And in particular, how can we extend that Euler-Townes regime to lower RF electric fields? I'm going to show you a setup that uses a three-photon scheme to try and make the line width of that EOT peak as narrow as possible. So for detecting RF pulses, we use this sort of standard two-photon scheme to detect them. Here's our vapor cell. We're just using a several centimeter long glass vapor cell with an 852 nanometer probe laser and a 509 nanometer coupling laser. And then we have, for test purposes, our RF horn that's supplying. Here, I'm going to talk about 19.4 gigahertz transition, but we've tried this experiment at other frequencies, including a 4 gigahertz and an 18.8 gigahertz transition, and they give very similar results. So in order to detect pulses, what we're actually going to do is we lock all of these lasers on resonance to the atomic transitions using an ultra-stable cavity. And you'll see the difference between, this is when the RF is off, this is the probe laser transmission, versus when the RF is on. And you get the biggest change in transmission if I started with the lasers locked onto that peak. So in everything I'm going to talk about, we're going to be locking both of those lasers to that peak. And this is a typical pulse that you get. The blue is the response, the change in transmission that you see in response to the pulsed RF electric field, which is modulated, shown in red. So this is a 10 microsecond pulse. And our goal here is to understand one part is to understand what are the time constants that go into this pulse shape, what dictates it, and the other is to see how precisely we can detect the arrival time of the pulse and what's the weakest field we can detect that pulse at. So this is a typical pulse shape that we get from this sort of experiment. In pink is a single trace, and the darker is averaged over several cycles, so you can better see the shape of the underlying pulse without the noise. It consists of several timescales. On the front, you have a fast, rapid transient to the pulse, and that's usually less than 100 nanoseconds, something like 50 nanoseconds. It's followed by this slower transient that takes several microseconds before the pulse kind of saturates to its full depth. And then once you turn the RF field off at this point, there's some also, again, several microsecond long recovery. If I try to go from a 10 microsecond to some shorter length pulses, you see that the shape at the leading edge is the same. But now the overall pulse depth is weaker once I get below that slow time constant, that 2 microsecond time constant at the front. What that means is it becomes increasingly hard to measure pulses that are below this sort of 2 microsecond limit because you're dominated by more signal to noise. It becomes a battle. On the other hand, because you have that fast initial transient at the leading edge, you can still, in principle, detect pulses that are on the order of tens of nanoseconds, possibly. So to better understand what goes into the timescales of these pulses, we turn to a density matrix model, which looks at the variations in the populations of the different states. We input into there the Rabi frequencies of the two lasers. The RF Rabi frequency is pulse modulated, so it's a time-dependent system. And we input into there several known decay rates. So these are things like this is the D2 decay rate that's well known in cesium, and some other decay rates. We also include a transit time. So if you have atoms that are at room temperature or hot, they're moving around. And so they can zip perpendicular through the beams, and they're only within the optical kind of volume for a finite period of time. And so that kind of gives you a rate. The atom leaves, and you can think of it as kind of a decay where it's replaced by an incoming ground state atom. So that gives you a number based on the radius of the laser beams. And then I'm not going to talk about it a lot in this talk, but we find that if you have laser conditions where your Rydberg populations are higher, then it's helpful in this model to capture the pulse shape by including this sort of dark state, which captures things that are like that generate either ions or some state-changing Rydberg collisions. So you get these atoms into some other states, which no longer optically interact with this system, and it takes some time for them to kind of decay back or be replaced if they move out of the beam by some ground state atoms. And we can kind of capture some of these effects by this sort of dark state. So if we run this model on the pulses, then we see there's a fairly good agreement between, in blue is an experimental pulse, and in orange here's one of the modeled pulses. It shows the same things. There's a fast transient at the front edge, which is a very rapid re-equilibration of the probe laser of the lower level in the cesium, followed by this slow transient. And that slow transient is really dominated by the transit time, how long it takes those atoms in the Rydberg state, which are no longer really involved in the system once the RF is on, to move out of the beam. Finally, there's a recovery on the tail, which at low laser Rabi frequencies, we can capture it very well in the model, but you'll see at higher Rabi frequencies when we have things like collisions and ions, the model doesn't quite capture this as well. So on the front edge, you see that rapid transient that was sort of 50 nanoseconds or less. We find that this transient is kind of sharper or deeper at lower probe Rabi frequencies. So that compared to, say, the red curve where there's hardly any dip there at all. And so if you want to detect very short pulses experimentally, then you want to look at, in general, lower probe Rabi frequencies. The second transient here I mentioned was to do to the transit time of the atoms through the beam. And we can see that if we vary the radius of the two laser beams, then the time constant of this, if we fit an exponential to that curve, we can extract a time constant which scales approximately with the beam size. And that's consistent with an explanation that there's the pulse shape is dictated by the transit time. Finally, we have on the trailing edge of the pulse, we're also, there's some things that are captured in this model, the slow buildup of the Rydberg state again once the RF is off, the transit time effects. But we also see experimentally a lot of very slow sort of effects that are sometimes present on that tail, especially at higher Rabi frequencies, especially in our coupling Rabi frequency. So you can see here, say the pink trace on the right is very flat afterwards, after the pulse, but if I have a higher coupling power, then there's these sort of long rippling things. And we believe those are due to, in part, anything that happens sort of collisionally with ions and electric fields in the cell. For example, if we move where the laser beams are going through the cell, so the lasers here are coming in and out of the page, and if I move them closer to the cell wall, where you would expect there to be some surface electric fields present on the cell, then I can see, say, on the pink one or the red one, more of these kind of slow effects. You can also see that the tail, which I'm not going to show, we have other data that supports that it depends a little bit on what atomic state you use. So some states are more susceptible to collisions compared to others. Some are more susceptible to ions. And so this tail depends on what state you're using, depends on how close you are to the walls of the cell, depends on what your coupling laser power is, so the population in the Rydberg state that can produce collisions and ions. And it depends on how much the laser is off resonance, in which direction. So again, it's sort of a collisional effect. These are hard to model. These very slow things with ions are in general very difficult to model, so we're not including them there. But they are a consideration for if you're trying to measure pulses at larger laser powers. It's actually a little better to avoid these things by working at lower powers. All right. So now I've kind of understood what goes into the pulse in terms of its shape. Now we're going to look at how do I detect an individual pulse, not averaging over a long time, just a single pulse of RF. Here's an example of a very noisy signal. This is a weak RF electric field. You can hardly see where the pulse is, but if I point it out, it's there. So what we do to try to extract this from the noisy data is something that's commonly used in communications, which is called matched filtering. And so it says if I know what the pulse shape is supposed to be, and I can get that either experimentally or I can get that using the model I just showed you, and I kind of sweep it, if I sweep it across the noisy data, and I look at the correlation between the cross-correlation between the data and the pulse, then it'll output a peak when this kind of template is matched, best matched to the data. And so it helps clean up a lot of the sort of white noise that's present in the system. And so that actually helps extend the range of what we can measure to weaker fields. Here are several examples of applying that match filter. If you have a very large splitting in the peaks here, this is just a continuous wave measurement. And then this is the corresponding pulse measurement. If I have a large RF electric field, then the peaks split very far. And so you have a large depth of a pulse. The amplitude of that's, once you're in that Otler-Towns regime where the peaks are fully split, your pulse depth is saturated. So you can't actually distinguish between a peak that's fully split and a peak that's slightly less fully split. And then as the peaks start to overlap, once again, your pulse depth starts to go down until you're in the amplitude regime and you're looking at very weak pulses. You can see in the light sort of shades that's what an individual pulse looks like compared to the darker ones, which is averaged over a couple of cycles. And then the output of the matched filter is here in response. And so the peak of the filter corresponds to essentially the time that the pulse has showed up, or rather the time of the end of the pulse, not the front of the pulse. And the amplitude of it kind of scales with the depth of the pulse. And so we might ask a few sort of engineering questions, which are, what's the best choice of laser powers that I should use, or Rabi frequencies, to measure these kind of pulses? The answer depends a little bit on what you're looking for. On the one hand, if I want to measure, to actually be able to know what the pulse amplitude, the RF electric field amplitude is, then I want to know what the depth of the pulse coming in was. And so then I care, then I actually kind of want these broad peaks because I can measure their overlap over a larger range. So that's, say, the pink trace. You can see there's a large range of RF electric fields where the amplitude varies. On the other hand, if I really want to measure a weak RF electric field, then what I'm looking for is the narrowest peak that I can get, and that's something I'll come back to in the second part of the talk. Then you can see that the height of that matched filter, or the depth of the pulse, is saturated when those EIT peaks are fully split. And then as I reduce the RF field amplitude into the amplitude regime, then you start to see the peak, kind of the matched filter output amplitude decrease. And so, yeah, if you're looking for really weak signals, the best thing you can do is work at a probe Rabi frequency that's very small. I'll mention that there is kind of an optimal coupling Rabi frequency as well. That's sort of an intermediate level, but I won't go into that here. So this is the performance that we see from these RF electric field sensors. There's two kind of metrics that we're looking at. One is the sensitivity on the left. What is the weakest field that we can measure? And so here I plotted the signal to noise ratio that I get from output from that match filter for an individual pulse, not an average, nothing averaged, compared to the RF field strength. And on the right, I plotted kind of the accuracy of your timing. So what timing can you resolve? And you can see, as I get to smaller and smaller RF fields, my pulse depth decreases, so my signal to noise gets worse, and so does my timing resolution. But at the smallest, it also depends on the duration of the pulse that you're trying to measure. So if it's below this kind of short, that 2-microsecond-ish time constant from the transit time, then it's harder to detect pulses just because your amplitude is lower compared to the noise. And so we find that the minimum detectable field we can get on an individual pulse is about 170 microvolts per centimeter. And if you convert that to a sensitivity with about a 2-microsecond timing, then that's something like 240 nanovolts per centimeter per root hertz, which is good for detecting an individual pulse. And in terms of timing resolution, we can get at larger pulses, we can get down to about, say, 30 nanoseconds or a bit less in timing the arrival of the pulse. In a lot of cases, we're limited a little bit by the way we've implemented the match filter in real time on an FPGA. So it's a little bit limited by the sampling rate there. That's something that can be overcome with different hardware. Whereas at the lower RF electric fields, you become limited by essentially your signal to noise ratio. There are a couple of considerations in terms of this system and using this sort of matched filter approach. Two things that make it not quite ideal is that there's some nonlinearity in the shape of the pulse. So you don't know, and when you're trying to use this as an RF sensor, you don't know what the amplitude of the incoming RF field is. And so you're stuck using a template that kind of assumes you know what the RF incoming field is. In general, that assumption works quite well, but you will see there is some slight variation in the shape of the pulse if I go from something that's kind of a high RF electric field down to something that's very weak, where you start to see some more overshoots on the front and the back. In practice, that gives you a little bit of a timing shift in your arrival time, but the match filter still does function. On the other hand, if you really wanted to be able to distinguish this like really well, then you could have two in parallel matched filters, one that runs with this shape and one that runs with kind of the one with the overshoots. The other issue that you can run into, as I mentioned, there's this long time scale at the end of the pulse that depends on your fields in the cell and your ion generation and those sorts of things. What that does is it means that your pulse kind of depth and your shape at the end of the pulse depends a bit on the rate at which the pulses are incoming. That effect is again reduced by reducing the Rabi frequencies of the two lasers. But it is something to take into account at higher laser powers. So one final thing we did just to see how well this sensor works is to try a little demonstration of actually detecting a radar signal. And so what we do is we make this simulation. Here I've got an airplane that flies past my receiver and it's got a little spinning antenna on it. And so every time the antenna faces my vapor cell, I see a series of pulses. And when it faces away, I don't see the pulses. And so if you put that pattern into the airplane's about, I don't know, a kilometer away, what you get out of the system is you can see these clusters of pulses whenever the spinning antenna faces your receiver. And here you can see this is sort of the antenna pattern that you get out of it, and it consists of these little individual pulses. You'll notice that the top is actually flat. So if you have a real antenna, your actual pattern looks something like you'll have a big globe in the center. And again, that's because your pulse depth saturates once you're in that Ottler-Towns regime, where you've kind of capped the depth of your pulse. And so that's why this looks flat up here. You can still sense them, but you can no longer distinguish the actual RF amplitude. And that if we try to see what that spatial resolution gives us in terms of radar, if we're looking at a timing resolution of say 30 nanoseconds, then that approximately corresponds to about 5 to 10 meters in spatial resolution. At a distance of about, I think I used a kilometer or something in there. So that's not bad for a radar application. Okay. So in the first part of my talk, I described what sort of limited the temporal resolution of pulse detection in these vapor cells, in these hot vapor cells. We found that you can detect pulses in principle down to 50 nanoseconds or maybe even slightly less. The shape of that pulse, however, is influenced a lot by the transit time of your atoms through your laser beams, and in part also by your any sorts of ions or collisions or background electric fields that you might have in the cell. Despite that, we were able to get sensitivities that are quite good, on 250-ish nanovolts per centimeter per root hertz, by using this matched filter that was tailored to the shape of the atomic response. And that sort of timing resolution makes this interesting for these sorts of radar applications. So in the second part of my talk, I'm going to talk about how can we improve the sensitivity of this even further. And in particular, how can we extend that Ottler-Towns regime to lower RF fields. So now I'm not going to talk about pulses anymore. I'm just going to talk about continuous wave RF fields. I'm going to go back to this two-photon scheme, which is what we used for the pulse experiment. And you can think of what limits the end of the Ottler-Towns regime in which I can measure the splitting of the fields. Well, it's really limited by how fat these peaks are. Once they start to overlap, you can't really distinguish them anymore. So you're limited by the spectral, by the line width of that EIT peak. And essentially, if you sort of do a quick estimate of what limits that, it's the fact that you have a 509 nanometer laser that's a different wavelength than the 852 nanometer laser. And so there's some wave vector mismatch in there, and that kind of pushes the atom and gives you a Doppler shift. And that Doppler shift will give you, at best, on the order of 3 to 3.5 megahertz, worse in practice. So EIT peaks are typically on the order of 4 or 5, maybe more megahertz in full width half max. So then you might ask, well, there isn't really a good combination of two lasers that are Well, you can't, yeah. You need lasers that are different wavelengths. But it turns out in cesium, you can actually get a three-photon scheme where you have a red coupling laser here, counter-propagating with a combination of a 2.2 micron laser and an 895 nanometer laser. And that combination, when you add up the wave vector mismatch, it's much, much smaller. And so those residual Doppler shifts are much smaller. And you can expect a resolution on the order of 20 kilohertz instead of megahertz. Now, in practice, you'll find that that's limited by a lot of other things. We've got things like laser line widths that matter. And we've got things like transit time that matter. And several other things that make, in practice, this number larger. But you can see the end result is that you've gone from something that's multiple megahertz wide to something that can be less than 200 kilohertz wide. And so that's really going to help extend that Otler-Towns regime. We can see that here's an example of the three-photon signal. The three-photon signal is a little bit different than the two-photon signal. You're looking at an absorption peak instead of a transmission peak. But you can still resolve this. And you can see as we decrease it's particularly sensitive to the red coupling Rabi frequency of that red laser. And if we work at higher laser powers, then we see something experimentally on the order of 300-something kilohertz. And if we, where we get the best peak height, so the best signal to noise, versus if we reduce that red laser Rabi frequency, we can get down to sub 200 kilohertz. Again, we might ask, well, what is the atomic limit of this? What's the ultimate limit on that resolution, spectral line width of the feature? And so we can use a density matrix model similar to what we used for the two-photon scheme. We've got our three lasers. We've got, again, several known decay rates between these different levels. We're using different levels than the two-photon scheme. So there's some differences there. You've got, again, a transit time describing the atomic motion through the laser beam. And then we've also got some dephasing associated with the laser line widths of the three lasers. And when we run this model, we can see if I don't include those laser line widths or transit time, and I use similar Rabi frequencies to what I've got experimentally, kind of in an intermediate value, then I get something that's got a line width of about 100 kilohertz. And then if I include those laser line widths, so those practical issues to implementing this, then we can see the line width gets a little fatter. Now we've got about 170, 180 kilohertz. And then if I include the transit time broadening, now I've got about 240 kilohertz of these values. So that's kind of the atomic limit that you can expect in this system is probably something like 240, 250 kilohertz. Experimentally, at these Rabi frequencies, we're getting something like 280, 290 kilohertz. So it's not that far off. And it's probably the best we could do. All right. So here's kind of final result is to look at that Otler-Towns regime. How narrow can you go? So now you can measure fields. Here's higher electric fields. Here's when the RF electric fields begin to overlap. And we can kind of distinguish about maybe 300 microvolts per centimeter, maybe a little bit less, somewhere in that range. And that's considerably less than, say, a two-photon scheme where you're talking over about 1,000 microvolts per centimeter in the Otler-Towns regime. All right, so that's sort of the those are sort of the two main projects I've been working on. One was I showed you what were the atomic limits on doing pulse-modulated RF electric field sensing with Rydberg atom vapor cells. We saw that we could detect very short pulses that are tens of nanoseconds, but are influenced by transit time effects. Nevertheless, using something like matched filtering to give us a better signal, we can get good sensitivity, and it's of interest for things like radar and communications. And then finally, I showed you instead of using a two-photon setup, we can use a three-photon setup, which has less Doppler shift effects, and that can reduce your line width from several megahertz to less than 200 kilohertz. extending the regime over which you have the advantages, the huge advantage of having a self-calibrated receiver. Right. There's a lot of people involved here. So most of them are here in person. So thanks. And thanks for organizing this conference.
Very low probe powers. Ah, now the microphone works.
If I can get
very
there.
Low powers. You see this overshoot. It's a late summer. I think it was this one.
This one here.
Yeah. So at low.
Low RF electric RF, fields.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's not
so
the probe
it's
power.
Low RF. You see the overshoot. And. Why is that? Why is it so nonlinear here? What causes that nonlinearity? Is it as you are in the you are changing between the outlet towns and the the whole thing is not in the outlet towns, and that's why it's quadratic or what? That's the whole effect. But why does it overshoot then? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay, thanks.
I have perhaps a naive question. You didn't mention optical depth of the system for the probe light. I guess there is some condition for the thing to work. Maybe it's pretty trivial. Mm.
So right now for the two photon, the pulsed experiment, we were using these vapor cells that are about 3 centimeters long on the optical. In depth, and then in the 3-photon, we're using something that's about 1 inch. We haven't tried changing that. It's probably of interest in the future to look at some very small optical depths. If you're looking for like a number, I don't have it off the top of my head, apart from like this is the length of the cell. I have it somewhere, but this was a while ago.
Okay.
All right, I have a question. Could you go to the slide where you show the data where you move the beam in the cell close to the cell wall?
Which way is it? This way. This one.
Yes. So there's some artifacts towards the return side that are kind of the same time order as the like fast dynamics that you showed earlier.
Yes, this stuff.
Yeah. And there's one even on the front leading edge too.
Yeah. This is from the way the triggering is going on in the oscilloscope. So some of these later things, we fixed some of those issues. Since then, this was a little bit of an older measurement. But this is sort of, there's a trigger box that goes to the RF generator, which will trigger the pulse, and then it'll go through the system and come in. And if you send this directly to the oscilloscope, there's some crosstalk between the different channels, and so that's what it's picking up there.
Okay, yeah.
It's not a real feature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One more question while you're on this slide. Can you give a rough scale for the position? How close to the cell?
Yeah. Sorry, I forgot to put a scale bar. Okay, this is a 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter vapor cell across. So this is moving in, you know, a couple millimeters at a time.
Okay, and so once you get to kind of within a couple millimeters, you start to see this.
Yeah, it's a stronger effect.
So just in the beginning, you mentioned that when you're working, calculating, or say determining the field strength from the measurements, that the transition moment is very well known. But how well known, or how, what kind of limit does this set from maybe a metrology point of view?
I believe it's the dipole moments are known to something like, what is it, Jim, like 1%, 0.5% maybe? 5%. Something like that.
25, oh, I see.
Okay, we should move on. Let's thank the speaker again.